Okay, so after hearing those two talks, it makes me want to ask, and this stuff is really only a few hundred dollars a ton. Tremendous technology and expense goes into the mining and the creation of those materials. So what I'm going to talk about will be a bit different, because when we're dealing with micronutrient manufacture, we're starting with a very different group of raw materials. And so that's going to be a big focus of what we do. I want to give some recognition to some colleagues who provided me with information. Vautrin Uren with Brandt Consolidated, Dale Edgington, who used to work for Agrium until we sold our micronutrient business this past summer. But he's now with Advanced Micronutrient Products, and in Agrium he was the purchaser of our raw materials and did the formulating at the plant. So he was a key expert in providing me with some of this information. So we'll recognize their contributions here as well. All right, so I put this chart up here, and this is an illustration. This is a contribution from Vautrin, who provided me with this illustration. But when we think about potash, we have 2, 3, 4 basic potash fertilizers, and pretty much encompasses everything that we do. Same with phosphate. We got MAP, DAP, and a little bit of triple super around, and some liquids. So we're really confined to a very short list of end products, and the manufacturing is all targeted to producing that short list of end products. When we get to micronutrients, it is an extremely complex world, and as you can see, we have a vast array of very different materials, different properties, different uses, and they're really almost all coming from a select group of raw materials. And how we get to these different materials is the manufacturing processes that we use. So we have everything from water-soluble salts to non-water-soluble salts, and we'll talk about that just a little bit, complexing agents, and we have chelating agents. And sometimes there's a lot of confusion over some of the differences and nuances between these. Complexes are not the same as chelates. They don't behave the same. They have different properties, and they're used differently. So we do have a lot of different materials. So the complexity here also creates complexity in how they're used. Now, we're not going to talk about how they're used. We're not going to talk about agronomics. We're really going to talk about this manufacturing business, and especially most of our time we'll spend on raw materials. So when we talk about micronutrient manufacture, the focus is on beneficiation of byproducts from other industries. Virtually all of our micronutrients, with the exception of boron, come from the recycling of industrial byproducts from a variety of different industries. Boron is the one exception that is directly mined and processed into fertilizer. Everything else comes from other metallurgical industries. And I've listed some of these here below, from steel making and what we call electric arc furnace dust. So you have these electric furnaces that are used to heat the iron ore, and there are some metals introduced into that process. And so in the process of heating that ore, there are fumes given off. Those metals are captured in a dust, and that dust is one of the byproducts of that industry, and that dust is often contains a fair bit of zinc. Smelters and foundries, and what we call brass fume dust, or sometimes brass mill dust. These are, again, dusts and fumes that are captured in emissions, cleaning up the emissions from these processes. Those are captured in something called a baghouse, and that dust is then sold to other industries, like fertilizer, for the production of fertilizer materials. They're often rich in the various metals, particularly zinc, in many of these things, zinc and copper, manufacture of brass and bronze and those various things. Tire incineration for energy. Did you know that many of the tires that are recycled are burned, incinerated, to produce electricity? And interestingly, each radial tire contains roughly a pound of zinc. So think about thousands, millions of tires being incinerated. This is part of the recycling process for energy production. And that tire ash is one of the materials that is used to manufacture micronutrient fertilizers. Galvanizing operations. Most of the zinc, vast majority of zinc that's used, is used for galvanizing, for protecting steel and iron materials from rust. So we coat the steel, we coat the iron with a zinc coating, and the zinc prohibits that corrosion. So skimmings from that operation, not all of the zinc material gets onto the finished product. So we have this excess that is collected and skimmed, and that those the skimmings from those galvanizing operations and the spent acids as well from that process contain considerable amounts of metals, particularly zinc, and those are used in manufacturing the micronutrients. Sometimes in mining, we have tailings that are rich in metals that are not particularly a target metal of that mine operation, but because they occur together naturally, the tailings of those mines can be recycled into fertilizer materials because they may be rich in various nutrients. And emissions from a whole variety of other industries in which metals are being used. So we capture those emissions, we clean the metals out of those, and we have, again, this baghouse dust that is used. So these are the materials, and these represent the vast majority of micronutrient raw materials that are used. But these are the materials that are being recycled into fertilizer. Now, because we're using recycled materials, they come with a certain set of challenges. And there has been a great deal of concern expressed over how these materials are used and the contents of these materials, particularly non-nutritive elements. And we're going to talk a fair bit about that. So there is an excellent EPA review of this micronutrient business. I've given a reference there below. It's a bit dated. It's from 2000. So it's 15 years old, but the information is still quite accurate today. It hasn't changed a whole lot, but it's about a 20-page document or so that goes through the different raw materials, the uses, and somewhat of the manufacturing, and even a little bit in the agricultural use of these. All right, so the niche of the micronutrient industry is the ability to take these raw materials, utilize the nutrient-rich byproducts, and convert them to usable plant materials. And the EPA actually greatly encourages this. And it is a good process. Yes, there are concerns, but it's important that we recycle whatever resources we can. Now, the fertilizer industry and the recycling of these materials is governed by what's known as RCRA, Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, and it governs a whole host of regulations around handling hazardous waste and materials that may not be always the most attractive. But I want to emphasize that we do not consider these materials waste, and EPA doesn't necessarily consider them waste. They are very useful materials for a variety of purposes and contain valuable plant nutrients. But there has been the perception over the years that the fertilizer industry is ungoverned, and there were many accusations made in the popular press in the late 90s and early 2000s, that the whole purpose of the fertilizer industry is for the disposal of hazardous waste. Those are the accusations that were made. There were a variety of exposés written in newspapers and on even on national television. And so there was a great deal of work done to correct this misperception, but it's still out there that our business is about disposing of hazardous waste, and that is absolutely not the case. And we are indeed quite regulated in the use of these raw materials. Now, it creates challenges because the metals that are essential plant nutrients, zinc, copper, manganese, iron, cobalt, are do in nature occur with some undesirable elements like lead, cadmium, arsenic. They are present together, and that's just the nature of the beast. So when we start using these materials as a fertilizer, we need to be concerned about the content of non-nutritive elements. And that is, like I said, regulated under RCRA. So, to give you some examples of some specific raw materials, zinc oxide can come from what might be considered a traditional mining source, but we're not mining that zinc for the purpose of getting zinc fertilizer. We're mining it looking for other things, but this for zinc, for galvanizing, for these other industries. So that ore is smelted and reduced to zinc metal. Well, in that process, zinc oxide is one of the things that's created, and zinc oxide is an excellent raw material for making fertilizer, so we capture that and use that. Another example, as I mentioned, is the galvanizing, collecting that unused product and then recycling that. So there are two kind of products that we might take out of that galvanizing industry. One is what's called the filter cake. So in the solutions that come off of that, there are solid material suspended in those solutions. So we extract some of the water and we get this mud-like material that's not real easy to handle, but this is one of the raw materials that's used. It's transported, oftentimes it's transported wet to a micronutrient manufacturing facility, so there are special challenges with that. Another material that comes off of this process is zinc sulfate heptahydrate, and so that's more the consistency of brown sugar. There's a little bit of water in it. There's some processing required for that. So these are a couple of good examples, and I mentioned the tire ash, and that radial tire contains about a pound of zinc. So some excellent sources out there. I use zinc for the example in many of these cases, but the story is really pretty much the same for the other metals, manganese, copper, and iron. So much of what we say about zinc is true for all the other things as well. All right, so some of the production issues created from utilizing these byproducts. The materials are available on an as-generated basis, so I don't always get to choose when I have to take this raw material. The producer of this raw material, this byproduct, is producing it on a schedule that may not coincide with my consumption schedule. So I may have to take this product whenever it's available, and I have to store that on site somehow. So imagine storing this mud-like galvanizing skimmings in a warehouse in some way, and it's quite a mess. So we're kind of at the mercy of the producers of these materials. Secondly, they're supplied as is, and we don't get to pick and choose what the nutrient content of the material is. We have to take what's available, and that means nutrient content varies, moisture content varies, sizing varies, presence of foreign material varies, and some of these materials have chunks of stuff, and they have to be either removed or ground or in some way dealt with, and we have variations in these unwanted riders, passengers, heavy metals that come along with some of them. So we have to be able to deal with that. So imagine if you're a blender formulating a blend of urea, DAP, and potash, and each bucket load of material you take out of the bin has a different analysis, different physical properties, different consistencies, and you're going to try to make a standard, uniform blend out of that and sell it. This is the challenge that we have with micronutrient raw materials because they do vary widely, and even within a lot of material, there are variations within that lot. So truly, each bucket load of raw material you may pull out of the bin and dump in the granulator could be different. So what do we do? Well, the producers of the users of these materials have to analyze all incoming raw material streams constantly. Every day you're analyzing those raw materials so that you know what you have. You try to segregate them when possible. So our operation in Reese, Michigan, we had some 15 or 18 different bins lined up for different raw materials, and you might have this zinc material over here and next to it a bin of a different zinc material and several different copper or manganese materials in this storage. So you try to segregate when you can, and you determine statistical averages, and then typically you might be mixing different raw materials so that you can have more consistency in the analysis. So as one is changing one way, another one might be changing another way. So there's a great deal of constant analysis and a lot of art that goes into the utilization of some of these materials. And then we have to constantly be analyzing the end product. So samples are being taken continuously out of the granulation stream to continue to analyze that product. Now, one of the old timers that worked at Reese, Michigan, and he had been there for 35 or 40 years, they said he could tell from the smell of the material coming out of the granulation, the visual appearance of that material and the smell and all of that. They said he could tell what was happening in the granulator, that he could monitor that way because he'd been doing this for a long time. There's quite a bit of art involved in that. All right, so you can imagine that this creates some costing challenges. So some raw materials are indexed from the commodity markets, London Metals Exchange and COMEX, and they fluctuate on a daily basis like stock or grain prices or any other commodity market. So you have raw materials available at different times. You may not be able to choose the price at which you buy it. Sometimes you can lock in long-term agreements with a supplier if you're willing to take everything that they produce. It simplifies their life, but that may not be what you want, but that may be the way you have to do it to lock in long-term contracts. These fluctuations are driven by supply and demand for metals and usually have nothing to do with the agricultural economy and the price of NPK, fertilizers, and other things. So we can have at times, like a few years ago when zinc and copper went crazy in price, metals just skyrocketed. And it may not, and so you may be at a price disadvantage. You may be purchasing at a price that's beyond what you're able to recover in the sale of those finished products. So that creates challenges. And the selection of raw materials, as I mentioned, isn't always driven by cost, because some materials don't granulate as well as others. Some materials don't dissolve in acids as well as others. So when we talk about a couple of different production processes, one of which is dissolution in concentrated acids, some of these materials don't dissolve very well. So you may not be able to use that if that's your production process. And others don't agglomerate very well in a granulation stream. So you also need to be aware of that. So not all raw materials are suitable for all uses. Oh, and the other thing is some may not become water-soluble in the finished product. And we'll talk a little bit more about that because that's a key consideration in the selection of the materials. All right, so let's talk a little bit about these non-nutritive elements because this created a great deal of controversy, as I've mentioned. So there's an organization called the American Association of Plant Food Control Officials. And I sit on a couple of different committees within this organization. It's an association of state Department of Ag fertilizer regulators, control officials in each state. APFCO itself is not a governing body, but it's an association of state government officials. But it's this organization that defines industry standards for labeling, product quality, characterization, terms and definitions around how fertilizers are described and labeled, and various standards around that. So one of the things when this became a really hot topic, one of the things that APFCO undertook in conjunction with the Fertilizer Institute and the fertilizer industry was to develop guidelines around allowable content of non-nutritive elements. And that was done via a risk assessment, a very complex and thorough risk assessment by the Weinberg Group, which is a consulting group in Washington that does this kind of thing. And so they looked at all aspects of the health impact of these non-nutritive elements and evaluated based on certain levels of risk tolerance how much could be allowable in a fertilizer, also taking into account maximum loading rates. So if our maximum loading rate is, say, 20 pounds of zinc per acre, what risk does that create if there is a certain amount of lead or cadmium in that zinc fertilizer? So a very thorough, the final document was hundreds of pages of output from this risk assessment, including all factors of health and different age groups and different, male, female, and all the different factors that they look at in these risk assessments to come down to what would be an allowable content in a finished fertilizer. Fertilizers that exceed these guidelines are defined by APFCO as being adulterated. So adulterated simply means stuff is contained in this fertilizer that shouldn't be there, basically. So there, to add to that, I'll give you one specific example, but to add to this, few, if any, U.S. manufacturers come anywhere close to these risk-based concentrations. Now, these risk-based concentrations also apply to phosphates. So these have been established because phosphate ores also contain some of these non-nutritive elements that are of concern. I'm only going to talk about the micronutrient levels, but know that this also applies to other fertilizers as well. And it's extremely rare that a commercial fertilizer would come close to these levels. There are some biosolid materials, however, that do approach, in some cases even exceed these risk-based concentrations. And it's all expressed based on nutrient content because we want to get to a quantitative loading rate of the metal. That's the basis on which the risks are established. So here in the second column, in the first column are the metals of concern, the nine elements for which this risk assessment was conducted. The allowable concentration or the risk-based limit of those metals per 1% of nutrients. So if I have 1% zinc, the risk-based limit, concentration limit, would be 112 milligrams per kilogram of arsenic, and you can read down the list there. Now, a couple of these, molybdenum and zinc, we know are essential plant nutrients. So the way this works out in practice is that if you label that fertilizer with a minimum guarantee for the nutritive elements, molybdenum and zinc, the risk-based concentration does not apply. But let's say it's a copper fertilizer and you're not providing a label guarantee for the amount of zinc, then zinc is considered a non-nutritive element and not a target for that fertilizer, and then that fertilizer becomes subject to a risk-based limit for zinc. So when we take, and I pulled an example here of an actual product from the market, a 20% zinc material, and so you can see the total concentrations listed there in the third column. The total concentration that would be allowable under that risk-based limit for those elements in a 20% zinc fertilizer, and considering maximum loading rates that could be used. Now, the maximum loading rates also are very conservative. The maximum loading rates are very much higher than what is typically used. So what they're trying to do in the risk assessment is get to, you know, a maximum, a very conservative estimate of what could be allowed. And then on the right-hand column is the actual content of these metals in this particular fertilizer. And this is an actual fertilizer that's sold on the market. So you can see that this fertilizer is orders of magnitude below the risk-based concentrations. And these are very typical numbers for products that are commercially on the market. There's also a reference at the bottom of that slide for the source of that information. You can go to APCO's website. There's a link for non-nutritive elements, heavy metals, things like that there. So let's talk briefly about the manufacturing. You take these raw materials, and I've sorted this out into three basic processes. Now, you could be much more detailed in how you do this, but this is kind of how I thought about it. There is one process that is a simple acid granulation. Now, this is one of the oldest fertilizer technologies we have. Some people call it ammoniation. Some people call it homogeneous granular fertilizers. It's been around a long time. We simply take these raw materials. We add sulfuric acid. We add a little bit of ammonia. It creates heat and moisture. There's a reaction because the raw materials are typically oxides, so the oxides start to react with the acids. So we get this exothermic reaction, we get heat and moisture, and that causes the material to start to agglomerate. And so in a rolling drum granulation, we move those through that drum, it continues to roll and tumble, and so we get more or less spherical granules forming as the material agglomerates. All the while through this process, there is some chemical reaction taking place. So we get a partial acidulation of the material. So some of those oxides convert to sulfates. The end product of this type of granulation we call in the industry oxysulfates because they're partial oxides and partial sulfates. And they may range anywhere from a few percent oxide or a few percent sulfate to maybe as much as 85 or 90% sulfate, depending on the amount of acid, the time in that granulation unit. So in the world of oxysulfates, we have a really wide variation in product properties. There's no filtration of these materials. There's no purification, and it's the lowest cost way to make granulation. So these materials tend to be the lowest cost products. But because there's no filtration, we have to be very careful about the raw materials that we buy. We're not taking anything out. Everything that's in the raw material goes into the fertilizer, so we have to be very careful about the raw materials that are used for that process. And then all it is a matter of drying and screening that material. The second process that's used is what I call an acid reaction, where we completely dissolve the oxide raw material in a concentrated acid, almost always sulfuric acid, so we form soluble metal salts, sulfates being the predominant form. So now we have a completely soluble material. We have it in a liquor or a saturated solution of this salt. And then we take that salt and we dry it and granulate it by one of several processes. It may be a fluid bed granulation, or it may be air drying or something like that. These are more medium cost. There is some filtration and some purification that takes place. We can selectively precipitate some of the non-nutritive elements and get to a more pure form in the end. So using this process, we have a little bit more flexibility in some of the raw materials we can use because we're removing some of those non-nutritive elements. And so then we have spray drying fluid bed granulations, and some of these are actually sold as liquids for use in a variety of other things. And then the third process, it comes to this other group of materials, the chelates and the organic acids, in which we react these oxides with chelate acids or complex acids, organic acids, to get various chelate and organic formulations, organic complex formulations. These are the highest cost materials to produce because those chelates and organic acids come with a higher cost and the reaction is more expensive. And then we typically would use something like spray drying to dry these, where simply the liquor is misted into a tower with the airflow, a hot air blowing on that, and it dries into powders that we can then later redissolve into water if we desire. So those are the basic manufacturing processes. Like I say, you can separate that out a little further. Now I want to say just a few words about this business of solubility, which has also been quite controversial, but I don't know why it should be controversial, because there's quite a bit of data, quite a bit of study that's been done on this, and I'll reference the late Dr. John Mortved, who spent quite a few years with TVA studying the nature of micronutrients and the properties we need to have. And based on quite a few years of research, he said both zinc sulfate and zinc oxide, so one being 100% water soluble, one being completely insoluble, are equally effective when applied as a powder and thoroughly mixed with the soil. Now, how many of us apply powders and thoroughly mix it with the soil? That's not very common. However, if applied in a granular form, zinc sulfate is still effective, but zinc oxide is ineffective. So when we consider the parameters in which you're going to be used, they tell us something about the choice of these. He went on to say that, okay, that being true, we now need to know the fraction that is water soluble in order to understand crop response. There's a trade-off between cost and agronomic effectiveness. TVA research shows that 35 to 50% of the total zinc should be in a water soluble form. But it's a buyer beware, because only two states require any solubility labeling. So this is not information that you'll find on the label. So if you don't trust your manufacturer, you need to actually test for solubility, because water solubility is a key indicator of agronomic effectiveness. So just a couple words about boron. This is, I think, my last slide. Are we done? Okay. All right, so boron is one that's mined. The largest deposits in the world are in Southern California. It's mined from a couple of major ores, borax, which is sodium borate, a water-soluble material. It's often solubilized, purified, and either regranulated or spray-dried. The other mineral is something called ulexite, which is sodium calcium borate. It may be granulated directly by some of the processes I've already illustrated, or it may be reacted with acids to form boric acid, which can then be used to make other things, reacted with a variety of other products. So boron is the one of this group that we do mine and process directly for fertilizer, and it's typically not coming from another byproduct. So with that, I'll wrap up and say, You know, the micronutrients, I think, is an underappreciated world of soil fertility. There hasn't been a lot of research on micronutrients in the last 30 or 40 years. Much of what we know is comes from quite old research. And there's still a lot that I think we don't understand about the soil chemistry of micronutrients. So with that, I think I'm finished. And I did my job in not leaving any time for questions.